Thank you, everybody, and thank you, members of the panel. As Nick indicated, we're going to talk about alternative sources of ship finance. Our panelists today are John Ong, directly on my left, who is the Managing Director and Head of Corporate Finance of Capital Markets. By the way, I'm Clay Maitland, and I'm a Managing Partner of the Marshall Islands Ship Registry, which is not an alternative capital market, but never mind. To John's left is Hamish Norton, Managing Director of Jefferies. And to Hamish's left is Peter Sorkin, Director of Transportation Research, Knight Capital Group. And what I believe our panel will discuss, and I'm sure they will, is in a way this is kind of the mystery panel because there are if there's anything exciting happening in ship finance today, it's happening with regard, I think, to alternative financing options. First question, which I think, if you don't mind, I'll ask a question, and then I'm going to encourage our panel members to interrupt each other, fire questions at each other and at me, and so we can get a dialogue going and hopefully keep the audience, you faithful people who have stayed, interested in what we're talking about. Pardon?
I'll interrupt you now.
Would you please? That's wonderful, John.
Yeah, you forgot to say I'm from ABN AMRO.
What did I say about you? You are ABN AMRO Securities USA, LLC, a limited liability company. By the way, that's relevant. John, go ahead.
No.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, let me fire the first question. Obviously, there are alternative financing options available. We have actually touched upon them. The previous panel did to some extent. Why do we call them? I'll ask a very simple question to begin with. I'm a lawyer, and therefore I don't know very much about finance. Why do we call alternative financing alternative financing? What is it an alternative to, and why? Go ahead.
I think if you first ask the question, what is the more traditional form of financing for shipping, it helps answer the question, which when you've heard the last couple panels talk about the capital markets, which are a traditional source of how the shipping companies get access to capital, that is one source. Another source being what was probably one of the earlier panels today, being the bank groups, which are available for more traditional senior financing. In both cases, they're both still available. However, I think the content suggested that they're limited. So as alternates to that traditional financing, I think that other sources that are more becoming more traditional as alternates, one being leasing and looking at the physical asset in the fleets of these operators as sources of potential capital. And at Knight, we're using the assets as a means to approach clients to determine if there's an opportunity to help them create liquidity around the business by really digging down into the fleet itself and trying to finance assets in that manner.
Thank you. All right, John.
Well, if we're adding definition, I mean, the alternative universes of hedge funds who seem to embrace the word, they are happy to be referred to as alternative capital. And again, the private equity community, as we talked about in the last panel, and I think I will reinforce what was said before. I think anecdotally there is a sharp rise in interest, perhaps corresponding with the fall in value.
With falling bank financing flows, which contribute to falling values, presumably, we're seeing a sharp increase in interest in various alternative vehicles. I grew up in a very simple, plain vanilla world, if you will, where ships were financed with a mortgage, and the vast majority of facilities, as we called them then, probably still do, were mortgage-based financing. With the arrival, and we're seeing names like Oaktree, for example, come around in connection with the appearance, naturally, of certain companies that are now in some distress, what kind of security is available to a lender of the Oaktree kind? Hamish?
In General Maritime, Oaktree was prepared to do something rather non-traditional in terms of taking a third lien debt position, which was sufficiently unsecured. It was a secured loan, third lien, but sufficiently risky that they could not charge enough cash interest to make it attractive. So in order to increase their rate of return, they took warrants in General Maritime as well. Now, obviously, that bet did not play out the way they had initially intended, but it has put them in a position to play a very important role in the restructuring. And, in fact, their investment may turn out quite well at the end of the day.
Thank you. Now, I realize I've gotten a little bit ahead of each of the three of our speakers, and I don't want to do that. John, did you have a presentation that you wanted to give? In other words, you know, a set-piece statement, because I know that Hamish has some things he wants to show us, which I have been privileged to eavesdrop on, and which are very interesting. But would you want to go first?
I'm happy to.
Why don't you go ahead?
Your instructions, I've
no there are no instructions
actually prepared
here. This is,
remarks.
This is a very free form.
But
we're in Greece now. You can do whatever you want.
But I'll make the couple observations. First of all, that as I said before, I think the current low value environment is increased the amount of interest from alternative investors in the space. I think there's probably still a perception of shortage, that there's been a lot of interest from issuers or companies looking for equity or subordinated capital, and certainly have been going through the sidewalks and hallways of New York for some time. But the number of those is growing, but I think the audience for that demand is also growing, and probably fairly significantly. Shipping may not be the model for classic private equity, with private equity's emphasis on maybe the human side of capital and using the human element to find value and unlock value. And in some ways, it's neither other than distressed deals. It's not the classic thing for alternative hedge fund style investment. But it's combination of buying assets in a fairly transparent market, but with the human ingenuity about how to deploy those assets in the right way. I think it's a bit of a over time. Both hedge funds and private equity see the appeal. And again, I think the education process of the last few years is well advanced. And I think
finally, we hope so.
And finally, we have a time when I now see people who have existing portfolio companies that are doing more, and those that have been looking for years seem to be finally willing to take the bait. And then there are more their new entrants. So I think it's just a fairly optimistic time to expect that alternative sources can fill the gap that that banks aren't there for.
That's very helpful. I don't know. I listened carefully to Dagfinn Lund during his brief presentation at lunch, and he seemed to be saying that it's best to get money outside the regulatory system if ship owners can do it. Do you agree?
Is that directed at me?
I would like to direct it at you, because I'd like to give you an opening to present your little response.
Yeah, I mean, now that bank financing, apart from that offered by DVB, has become largely theoretical, I want to discuss a couple of theoretical alternatives. Now, one of which is very familiar, I think, to most people in the shipping industry, which is the bond market, where you can issue senior unsecured debt or senior secured debt at long-term bullet maturity fixed rates and with no maintenance covenants. And, you know, it's a pretty expensive source of debt right now. But actually, there is a related source of debt in the U.S. capital markets that may be of greater interest to the shipping community, especially going forward, which would be a source of first mortgage floating rate bank debt. They call it bank debt, but it's sold to mutual funds that set themselves up as bank loan mutual funds that buy this product called leveraged loans. And there has not so far been really any leveraged loan issuance by shipping companies, but I think that this is just a matter of time and a little bit of education. And, you know, frankly, I think what we really need is a candidate issuer to go around and educate buyers, and I have some slides. Is the slide person? A clicker would be great.
We got him.
And I'll try to go through them very quickly so that we can not interrupt discussion too much and Q&A too much. Thanks. So, basically, just to remind you what the bond market is like, right now, if you're an industrial issuer in the U.S., the bond market has never been better. And if you're a double B-rated U.S. issuer, the yield on a typical bond is 5.5%. Amazing. And the yield for a single B issuer is 7.2%. Really just about all-time lows in terms of interest rates. Unfortunately, shipping is not as well thought of in the U.S. high-yield bond market. Average shipping bonds, unsecured, are trading at 11.2%, secured 10.5%. It's pretty expensive finance for a shipping company, which is why you haven't seen too many bonds issued recently. And then, the market performance, again, you can see that the yields for the double B and the single B index, which are the bottom two lines on the graph at the right, are pretty low relative to where they've been historically. Now, the red line and the white line at the top of the graph on the right are very interesting. This is the European high-yield double B and single B index. The European bond market, whether denominated in euros or even denominated in dollars, has not tracked with the U.S. bond market, not even close. So you get a lot of European issuers coming to the U.S. Funds flows, this is a measure of money coming into the bond market. It is not the whole bond market. It is the mutual funds where we can track the funds flows. The reason the yields are so low is that a lot of money is coming in to invest into the high-yield bond market in the U.S. And as a result, you see new issue activity is very strong. Year-to-date, $52 billion, of course, not shipping bonds. This is mostly a primer to remind you what the bond market is like, because then I'm going to move to the leveraged loan market. And this is basically where U.S. companies go, in many cases, to borrow what they call bank debt. The leveraged loan market buys products that are written like bank loans. They look like bank loans. They have bank-type covenants. They are very often secured loans. But they are sold to mutual funds, not banks. And the mutual funds are very often unleveraged. Some of them are collateralized loan obligations, may be leveraged. But, they're not in a regulatory framework like the bank framework. They're not short of capital. Now, what's interesting is that the yields are lower, although they're still pretty high compared to what ship owners remember from the good old days of shipping bank lending. So a high single B U.S. borrower is borrowing at about LIBOR plus 440 basis points right now. A mid-single B issuer is borrowing at LIBOR plus 529 basis points. So, you might imagine that around LIBOR plus 500, there might be an interest. As I say, somewhat theoretical because it hasn't been done in shipping, but there's no good reason why not. The leveraged loan market has not been as robust in terms of money coming in as the bond market, but still there have been net positive flows recently. And, of course, as you see, LIBOR plus 400 or 500 is still quite a bit lower than the bond yields. Now, the new issue activity in the leveraged loan market is really very large. In 2011, $370 billion worth of leveraged loans were placed in the U.S. leveraged loan market. Year-to-date, $48 billion, not much different from the bond market in aggregate. And I know you can't read all those numbers, but the issuance has been strong and getting stronger in 2012. No reason why the shipping industry cannot take advantage of this. So covenants in a high-yield bond, I know you can't read all this, but basically the point here is that there are limitations on your ability to incur additional debt once you've issued a bond, limitations on your ability to pay a dividend, but no maintenance covenants. Your business can go slowly downhill without violating any bond covenant. That is not true of a leverage loan, which looks a lot like a bank loan. It will have amortization. It will have maintenance covenants. The leveraged loan market is not used to loan-to-value covenants the way shipping banks have historically put them in. The leveraged loan typically has interest coverage minimums, fixed charge coverage minimums, senior debt leverage maximums, minimum EBITDA, all cash flow-based covenants. My suspicion is that to make it succeed in the shipping industry, we're going to have to get people used to loan-to-value covenants, which actually are probably easier for shipping companies to live with. Leveraged loan investors all over the country, largely mutual funds. Now, important point, you can go to a shipping bank, or you used to be able to go to a shipping bank, and get money for a single ship acquisition or two ships. In the leveraged loan market, the median transaction size is $311 million, only a little bit less than the median bond offering of $395 million. So we're talking about financing a fleet, not a ship. This is going to favor the larger shipping companies. And you can see that there is a size premium. That's one of the reasons the median deal size is as large as it is. Deals over $200 million in the leveraged loan market yielded 1.26% less than deals under $200 million. So there's a good financial reason for a borrower to package a bunch of his ships into one fleet to finance this way. Similar size premium, in that is lower interest rate on a larger bond than a smaller bond. And that's it for the presentation.
Okay. Is it fair to say there's likely to be a minimum LIBOR or minimum yield and some form of call protection?
There's very, very often a minimum LIBOR. If it's a LIBOR plus 450 basis point spread, they may put in a LIBOR floor of 1% or 2%. Occasionally, these are done without a LIBOR floor, but it is more common that there is a LIBOR floor. Generally, there is some kind of call protection in the leveraged loans, yes.
Well, Peter, do you agree that this is a viable option?
I am not personally very familiar with leveraged loans, so I'm not going to really comment on whether I think it is or not. However, I do have a topic that complements the leveraged loan product, which based on its size sort of offers a premium, if I understand it, for fleets where individual financings might be more opportunistic. I wanted to talk about the sale-leaseback.
Yeah.
So we like sale-leaseback transactions, and to illustrate one of the reasons why they might be something that could be attractive to an operator, if you take the case of a publicly traded shipping company, a lot of them suffer or feel that their real value is not appreciated by the market. And if you look at the market cap, it's often below the net asset value. So the question has always been, how do you unlock some of that value and get a better appreciation from the market for what's really the underlying assets in the fleet? One way to do that is through a sale-leaseback transaction. And effectively, what you're doing in that transaction is going into the market with an investor who will buy the asset at its fair market value and lease it back for a series of cash flows. That implicitly is suggesting that the fair market value is being realized for the asset, as opposed to what the equity market is otherwise assigning to the market capital at a lower level. So you're really trying to free up liquidity and value in the asset by entering into a transaction like this, the benefit of which is not only extracting the real value of the asset and putting that money to work in a way that might be more productive, but also the opportunities to create liquidity for your business and also manage debt. There may be certain situations where shipping companies may find it favorable to help a lender in terms of taking the cash from that transaction to reduce leverage. That type of transaction, I think the sale-leaseback could be a scalable opportunity as well. There are plenty of institutional investors looking at opportunities like this, and we think that it's not just a single asset that an operator could consider, but actually they could do multiple transactions involving sale-leasebacks. And back one more point on the kind of the market cap and NAV topic I mentioned. I think if you look at certain fleets that are associated with public companies, you may actually find that not only is there a kind of a misperception as to what the real underlying value of the fleet is, but even more so with respect to individual assets in a fleet, meaning that there may be individual ships that have much greater value on a net equity basis on a disproportionate level. So the ability of the operator to selectively do a sale leaseback transaction may actually provide even greater value because it won't actually impact the market cap of the company while taking that single asset and creating a substantially greater amount of value. So we've been working on these types of transactions at night, and we think it's a good opportunity for shipping companies to find alternative capital from institutional investors.
Tell me, Peter, thank you very much. How do you deal with the situation where the valuation, there may be what I would call a discrepancy in valuation? How do you actually value the ships yourselves? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the physical asset itself we would assign a value to, and essentially it's the fair market value in the asset. And in the sale leaseback, what you do is create a series of lease cash flows that the investor would purchase, and that too is based on what we would consider to be either the time charter or bareboat rate.
Can you actually, I'll ask anyone who wants to talk about it, is it possible to do a combination of these things?
We've heard from Hamish, and we've heard from you. Is it one from column A, one from column B, or does it have to be one or the other? In other words, let's say you've got a potential for profitable or valuable sale leaseback. Is that the only thing you can do if you opt for that, if you're a ship owner? Or can you also do a junk bond flotation? High yield.
Well, maybe not on the same vessels.
Yeah, although you know, what can happen is that the lessor could do a leveraged loan against the vessel that they have purchased and sold back.
That's right. There's a whole separate financing associated with that part of the transaction.
And of course, I mean, there's nothing to prevent a shipping company from tapping every source of financing available
right.
to it, and you know some of them do that. You know, OSG has got just about every kind of financing.
That's exactly what I had in mind was that example.
Yeah.
So there's it's a little bit more like a Chinese menu than it is like a regular menu.
And I think on the investor side, too, there are investors who invest both in pure vessel equity mm-hmm. or in the equity of vessel-owning companies who also diversify by owning the equity, you know, having more of a mezz-like return, lower return, but with sort of enhanced access to assets by participating in sale-leaseback equity.
All right, I'm going to ask the big question. You are three specialists, and we've heard from a lot of specialists today, but I consider you to be three very prominent specialists. You've shown some very interesting, described some interesting options today in the last half hour or so. What do you think the prognosis is for a turnaround in the market? We'll talk about dry bulk first, if you want, because a great deal of what we're talking about here is really, to my mind, hinges on an effective means of forecasting, and I think you probably got some pretty good ideas.
But I think in the time frame that most of these transactions involve, medium term or longer term, I mean, clearly the upside is far greater than the downside in today's environment. So both on rates and values. I mean, even if the current rate environment continues to put downward pressure on values. By historical standards, this is a very interesting time, and I think that's the way more and more investors are looking
going.
At it.
Yeah.
Clearly,
I would paraphrase Dwight Eisenhower, mm-hmm. and I would say that every dry bulk turnaround will astonish you.
Peter,
okay,
you agree with that?
Well, I think that the dry bulk situation has still some time to play out. However, it doesn't mean that there aren't investors who are willing to take risk in that time frame. And I think specifically it's opportunistic given the condition of the industry and its impact on valuation for investors to take advantage of what are relatively low cost assets at this point and anticipate that that recovery, which may be sometime in the future, whether it's 1 year or 2 years out or even further, who knows, to take advantage of the price in the market today to buy those assets and appreciate the value that is associated with the recovery, both with respect to rates and underlying asset values. And so when we look at the opportunities in the market right now to acquire assets in this context, it makes sense to us and investors to jump in and structure opportunities to buy assets that later down the road when the recovery does occur will actually have very significant appreciation.
Well, I like being unpredictable, and I think you've made some very interesting points. And what I'd like to do now is go straight to the audience and ask if there are any questions on these points. Yes, sir. Microphone over there, please.
Hello. I wanted to ask Peter a question about the lease financing. As I think everybody is aware, Greek shipping companies incur very little taxation for legitimate reasons, may I add. So a leasing transaction, does that also provide the benefit of passing on a tax break that the purchaser of the asset has and therefore sharing that benefit effectively in the lease payments?
Yeah, I think there's two elements that answer that question. The owner, the buyer, will have the benefit of tax depreciation of the asset. However, the offset also from the seller, the shipping company, is that they will be incurring greater rental expense, which should act as theoretically a tax shield with respect to income, assuming that there is income.
I should point out, though, that while there are ship lessors in taxable jurisdictions, most ship lessors of which I am familiar go out of their way to organize themselves in non-taxable jurisdictions because their total profits end up being higher. So while you are correct that some lessors get the benefit of tax depreciation, the bulk of the lessors actually don't pay tax either. And so it doesn't actually work out that way in practice.
And I'll add to that, I think a lot of the institutional investors who would approach an opportunity to own and lease an asset back to the shipping operator are really not necessarily factoring in the tax benefits as much as the cash yield and ultimate recovery of the asset.
Great. Good. Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see. Yes, in the back of the room, Mr. Kane. The microphone headed your way, so.
Hi, gentlemen. I thought I'd ask in general how much, you know, I think lease structures are fine. There are a few boutiques that haven't been around. The KSs are hurting badly, KGs as well. FSL, as best I know, as well. How much real leasing is being done right now? That's the question.
I think that as a form of alternative financing, it's going to be an increasing source of capital. I think what is attractive from institutional investors who have not traditionally been involved is that the appeal of owning a physical asset is actually a form of risk management. And what we've kind of advised clients who are looking at the space, the closer you are to the asset, the better the risk context. And what that means is there's plenty of opportunities for investors to get involved in different areas of ship finance. You know, specifically, they could buy bonds in the market. They could also actually buy bank loans in the secondary market as well. But if they have the opportunity to attach directly to an asset, we think that's a better risk context because the closer you are to that asset, we believe the better protected you are. And so as a result, what you would traditionally find as institutional investors buying bonds and loans, I think will gravitate closer to the leasing market where they can earn, I believe, better yields and also have a better protected structure.
I think there will be new entrants. I mean, I agree. It's been some known and specialized sources of financing for this, but I'm aware of a fund that's just decided to put $500 million into sale-leaseback equity and shipping if they can find the right transactions.
How much was that?
$500 million.
Well, that's pretty good.
It's a big number.
Yeah, it's a nice, you can throw a good party with that. Any other comments from members of our panel? Any other questions? Going once? Going twice. Well, I want to thank our panel. Thank you, John and Hamish and Peter. I know we actually finished up a little bit quicker than some of the other panels did, but the hour does grow late. I know there's a final panel that we're going to hear from. Thank you again. Let's give a round of applause to our members of our panel. And thank you very much, Nick and Olga and Eleni, and I don't know your name, but thank you very much again for all your help organizing this conference. And thank you to all the sponsors.